This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hi there, welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This is being recorded on January 20th, 2010. Today we are talking to Rob Connery and James Avery, also known as the Tech Pub Mafia. We're talking to Rob, so we pretty much have no idea what the hell we're going to be talking about, so let's just get started. Rob, welcome back. Longtime friend of the show, welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much, and I think I can finally say, Phil, I've upped you.
Well, he's coming on next week, so no, just kidding. What should we talk about, Rob?
Well, my goodness. You know, so I went through a string of a number of evenings for some reason. I mean, I was working really late, I guess what it comes down to, and I was on Twitter, which I shouldn't have been, and someone would just write something, and I swear, coming out of me was just like the cause du jour, and one night I think I got into it with you and Scott Kuhn and I don't know who else about object databases and NoSQL. And, you know, I think we took it offline and just kind of went rounders. So I guess we could start there. But you know what? I know there are so many things that are coming up right now in the ASP.NET universe. They all seem to be so intertwined. It's just bizarre. So I guess, you know, might as well start somewhere. We start there.
Okay. So Rob, you've posted a couple blog posts on the subject of object-oriented databases, how ORMs are, you know, so last year. You posted a hello from 2020 post that was sort of part prognostication, part call to action, part acid trip about, you know, what things might be like in the future. So why don't you give us the short view of your perspective on the subject?
You know, honestly, it's just, it's one of those things where, you know, I hate going off if I don't really have any significant background on something, you know, and I really try and understand sort of what it is that I'm railing against, if you will. And so I feel like, you know, after all these years, I mean, I wrote my own ORM and, you know, it's kind of come along and things are good. But after a while, you kind of look around and you go, why am I facing this problem every single time I write an application, right? And then you have a guy like Allende who comes on TechPub and doing the unhibernate stuff. And at first you're like, whoa, hey, that's great. Look at that. Oh my God. Wow. And the next thing, you know, I mean, you're diving into some crazy stuff, right? Some really deep stuff that's all really neat if you think about it in coding terms. Like, wow, I didn't know you could do that. But then when you take a step back and you get some perspective and you think, wow, really all I'm trying to do is get that little string value that's sitting somewhere in my database to show up on my web page. And you phrase it that way and you think, what is happening here? Because this is insanity. I mean, the amount of code I had to write to get that little string value out of my database and onto my web page is actually offensive. And so that's why I was just thinking, like, I really don't want to have to think about this anymore. And I'm surprised that I even need to, given that the web data-driven whole thing is now, what, 95, 4, 3, count backwards? I don't know how many years we've been doing this. My goodness. I mean, so that's where this all has come from. Like, come on, we can figure this out. We can persist data. Let's go from there.
So a lot of these kinds of solutions that are not relational databases kind of follow this NoSQL, you know, umbrella term. But it seems like that covers a lot of ground. You know, mm-hmm. You've talked about DB4O, object database stuff. There's MongoDB, which is a document database. There's key value stores. It seems to include a lot of different kinds of solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, you know, I noticed that your blog engine is driven by MongoDB. Is there some particular mm-hmm. reason why, you know, you picked that versus some other solution?
Yeah, well, I was building it with Rails. And at the time, you know, MongoDB has some great support in terms of using it with the Rails framework. And at the time, it was MongoMapper. That's what I used. And it made it all really fun. And so, you know, a DocumentDB is sort of like an object database. I mean, you can kind of think of them the same way. The whole point is that you're not writing SQL. You're just storing objects away. And, you know, a lot of people say, wait. You know, how am I going to report against that? You know, these objects that are stored and serialized down, I got some high-intensity queries that need to come off of there. And so then the question comes up, well, what is it you're querying? What are you doing? Let's stop and, like, get some context here, you know? And so, you know, people say, well, you know, okay, so, like, let's take an e-commerce application. I need to know what people are buying or what they're adding to their basket. And then you can stop and say, well, look, there's a natural sort of organic way of thinking about an application where you have data that an application needs to run, you know, like products, yeah? And you have, you know, users that are that come. It's like current information, if you will. But then the resultant data that comes out of that, right, is like an order or perhaps somebody adding something to their basket. You can track all that. That should go into a reporting style system, something that can spin queries and do, well, what a relational database does. So that's what I've always said. You know, there's actually two applications that you're building. One serves a purpose. One kind of puts itself in front of the person. It's the salesperson, if you will. But after the fact, the sale is a recorded bit of history. Yeah, stick that into a situation that you can glean some information out of it. In fact, bend it a little bit so you can glean the best information possible, maybe in like an OLAP situation or something to that effect.
Because really, that's kind of the root of this whole thing, is that everyone used relational databases for everything. But everyone who reported off of relational databases, your transactional database, then you were probably in trouble anyway. You were slowing down your production system. You were using it for two different things. So most people started going to having a reporting database and having a live database. So why does that live database need to be in SQL Server and a relational database? It doesn't need to be.
It has to be in SQL Server because that's the only thing that the other devs on your team understand.
Well, fair enough. But if I hire a truck driver, right? If I hire a truck driver, let's just say I have a friend who is a truck driver, right? I have a friend who drives a big 18-wheeler. And I say, hey, dude, let's go down the hill to our favorite bar and go have a beer. And he shows up in his truck. Well, dude, let's just go. What are you doing with your 18-wheeler in front of my house? Well, because it's what I know. Give me a break. I mean, I don't know. I don't buy that. You know, I think just because you drive an 18-wheeler every single day and that's what you know, that's the most appropriate thing to drive me to a bar. You know what I'm saying?
But then, yeah, I mean, why did anyone ever leave classic ASP? That's what people knew. Why did they leave VB6? That's what they knew. At some point, you've got to grow and learn something new. Not you specifically, Scott. I was just saying people in general.
But people make careers out of not learning anything new and just, you know, accepting whatever's given to them.
Uh-oh, I sense some sarcasm. Right.
Well, see, but those people are going to be working.
And just constantly, you know, working the presentation, you know, the presenter circuit.
Well, but see, those people are going to be working for me eventually, and I'm going to tell them they have to use MongoDB, and then they're going to have to learn it, or they're going to go get a new job.
Okay, so let's look at this from another point of view. So MongoDB is your choice, but I like Couch. Okay. So is it really object database versus relational, or is it Mongo versus the world? Or
No. I mean, I think so Couch, for people that don't know, so like Couch and MongoDB. So Couch is a very strict document database, whereas MongoDB is a mix of document and kind of relational ideas. But no, I mean, Couch makes perfect sense for lots of things, and Mongo makes sense for other things, and Redis makes sense for other things. It just depends what your use case is. And really, that's what it comes down to, is that instead of right now, we just use relational databases for everything. But there's a host of other databases out there that make sense for lots of different use cases. Like there's even graph databases. I didn't even know about these, but graph databases that make a lot of sense for areas where you're tying together lots and lots and lots of interrelated relational things.
So I think one thing we just kind of let pass was the whole thing of that it's so painful to use a relational database when really, I mean, with most ORMs, for a lot of cases, it's not. I mean, you point an ORM at a database, you say it maps tables to objects, and you just say, you know, users dot, you know, go get me a user with this ID or with this name or whatever, and it just does it. I mean, how much are we really saving by it seems like we're optimizing more for the, like, creating data and throwing it into the system versus everything else.
Well, I think the problem with ORMs is that they're really, really simple for simple things. But once you get into these really complicated stuff, it's incredibly, you know, complicated and convoluted. Like when you get into saving nested values on objects and object graphs, and how is this object being saved down? And if you delete this object, what is it doing with these objects? And I mean, that's a reason, you know, there's a reason Allende can sell an Hibernate profiler for that much money, because it's really, really hard. And there's a reason that the TechPub and Hibernate series, you see the plug there, is so long, is because and Hibernate's really complicated.
Which series was that? I didn't
That was the N Hibernate series on TechPub with Allende and Rob Connery.
Well, John, to jump in on this point, I mean, to make you think about this for a second, let's say you're writing a commerce application and you're writing your product class. So where do you write it? How do you define it? And I think you might do the same thing I would do if we had Visual Studio open in front of us. We might hop over to our database and define it as a table. So let me ask you this straight up question, and anybody jump in. What defines the product? What is the unique key that defines the product? So someone tell me that.
What? Well, okay. So, I mean, I think you're asking for what's the product ID or whatever, but I'm not sure that what's the point?
Well, here's the point. The point would be, if you're a programmer and you're thinking purely in OO terms and you're thinking about your domain, if you will, you know, the thing that uniquely identifies a product is its SKU, because that's what relates it to the business. That keeps your head in the game in terms of what the business is doing. And you start thinking in terms of SKUs. However, setting a SKU as a primary key in a database just generally isn't a good idea. I mean, you really don't want to have a key in a database that has any meaning to it. So you'd probably just use an integer key because it's fast, and you know, you go from there. So right there, you've made a compromise. That's a small one, right? It's a small one. Yet, you know, when people ask this question, what's the big deal? You know, really, what is the big deal? Well, the big deal is that you start thinking in terms of marrying relational tables to an object-oriented system. I mean, how many people truly code in an object-oriented way? And it's not like I'm trying to sit here in my theory box and, you know, pontificate with my little tricorn hat on and say, oh, everybody should be doing blah, blah, blah. It's not at all what I'm trying to say. Just saying that it doesn't serve what we're trying to do in terms of building these rich applications that address business concerns. We have to think about IDs and what ideas in our models, and how can we do foreign keys? How do they translate to our model? Well, they shouldn't. Foreign key is a concern of a database. I don't have foreign keys. I have nested collections. You see that there's a subtle difference there. But when you start actually programming your data that backs your application, in that sense, it just really starts to roll out in a much more organic way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think a lot of the time that in you know, people are moving to these models where you've got like a view model or something like that in the middle that kind of translates between the model layer and your application, which I guess is what you're saying, is that's part of the extra cruft, is that we're adapting our logic to fit to this whole idea that we've got an ORM that creates classes based on tables, et cetera.
Yeah, and it ends up being, and I hate using this term, but it's kind of the truth, it ends up being a code scab. I mean, I'm not against the presentation model. It makes a lot of sense to have a view model, presentation model, whatever. But then, you know, you kind of take a step back and look at your application and think, wow, I have an extra class in there to deal with this other class that defines exactly the same thing, but it's making it a little bit more palatable so I don't get yelled at by code better guys, you know, that kind of thing. So you kind of, I don't know, you kind of, it really backs you into a corner when you start thinking database first in terms of development.
So I got like a billion things here. Let's start with the most recent. Okay, so putting these intervening, you know, view model classes in there, isn't that just really an artifact of using a statically typed language?
Absolutely.
Because if you're using something that allows you to, you know, dynamically add methods onto or reflect over properties and things like that, mm-hmm. in Rails, mm-hmm. you don't really have to deal with that. But there's another kind of reason for having this intermediary view model, and that's that the view shouldn't have to contend with properties and members that it doesn't care about. So if your product defines things like supplier ID, source ID, you know, discount price, retail price, wholesale price, and the view that you're presenting only cares about the retail price and doesn't care about the supplier ID and all that, why should your view have to ignore certain members or properties of your model in order to know how to display itself or display the data on itself? That's point number one.
Yeah, not only that, but when you drop such a heavy kind of bit of data onto your view, it's just really, it's one of those things where you're sort of busting down some kind of door where it's almost tempting you to write logic on your view in order to get around all of it. I mean, the view doesn't need all that stuff like you're saying. And then, you know, at some point in a pinch, right, a couple months down the line, someone says, oh, well, we need to show the supplier on that page. Oh, well, I've got the ID right here. And you can see how that kind of takes you down a bad little rabbit hole.
I don't know that we really solved anything there.
I fail to see how the choice of a UI pattern is influenced by what kind of database you're using.
It absolutely is. So I'll give you an example as to why. So one of the things that I was trying to do for the Kona application that I've been building with Oren was to completely divorce the whole data access thing I had going on in the model with what I was showing on the page. I figured at the time that maybe some folks out there wouldn't want to have to deal with InHibernate, because InHibernate sort of bleeds into your application. It kind of the tentacles reach out and you're dealing with sessions in action filters, and it's not bad. But if you've given your application over to it, then it, your application depends on it, right? So I thought, well, at the very least, I don't want the Vue class to have to deal with the stuff I've defined on InHibernate. So I actually started redoing these big fat Vue models. I had to do that as a result of what I was doing with my data access, right? It just made me feel better. And it was maybe one of those silly things that I didn't need to do. But on all, the Vue didn't need to know all that stuff. It actually needed to know a lot of resultant sort of stuff that came out of InHibernate. Does that make sense?
Sure.
But
there's a lot of different reasons to use separated presentation patterns. One could be like in the Silverlight WPF land, it's because you're building a Vue model just so you can get make things easier for a designer who's going to be in Blend, who wants to see something that they can right-click on and set some properties and bind against, do data binding. But another reason could be because you have views that aren't just showing product information, but they're showing the product information and today's weather and three different other things. And that's not all stored as a single blob in a object database.
That's
in MVC land, you're using something like AutoMapper, mm-hmm. or in Rails land, you're using Active Presenter.
Mm-hmm.
On a whole bunch of extra stuff on your models.
I certainly agree with that, and I don't want to come off saying that I don't like the presentation model pattern. I think it makes a lot of sense. So if you have logic, like, am I going to display this button, for instance, or should we, let's say this, you want some logic, should we display administration controls? You'd want that to transcend not only your HTML view, but also Silverlight, if you have a Silverlight front end. And that kind of logic, you want to contain it in one place. That makes perfect sense. So there's a time, of course, for a view model pattern. But what I was trying to say is, you know, if you're using it to cover up or renegotiate, you know, database stuff coming down from your data access bits, it gets kind of scary.
Sure, I would agree with that too. And I would also agree that these types of alternate storage mechanisms reduce the friction in development quite a bit. But the hard part comes in sometimes making that sale in larger organizations, trying to get that accepted. It's just perceived as something that's risky.
True, and it's kind of the thrust of my post. I mean, it's one of those things where you can't really push one of those things, but you know, you can educate people, and that's sort of my little mantra of life. You know, it's all you can do is show people and say, listen, really, you know, in a capitalist society, you know, the masses can dictate based on, you know, supply and demand. We are the demand. And, you know, if enough developers rally around and say, look, you know, this is ridiculous, we can do something better, and start blogging it and start showing examples, start showing ways that, look at, you know, like using DB4O, for instance, I was able to jam through an application in literally a third of the time. And I was really happy doing it. And then, you know, I came out with it and it was done and everything is good. I ripped through my blog app using Mongo. I didn't have to deal with migrations. I didn't have to deal with a lot of the extra stuff that comes along with Active Record and trying to figure out eager loading and all that other stuff. It just was there. And so, you know, I was happy for it. So I blog it. And that was the whole thing about my post that I've been trying to go over and over again. Like you did, K-Scott. You know, I read your post about Mongo. You played around with it. And,
right.
You know, it's one of those things where you just show people this is what you can do, and you get them to play with it. They blog about it, and they tell two friends, and so on, right?
And that's kind of it's
the, yeah, you know what our motto is, Rob? It's be the change that you want to see.
Well, you know, I tossed out a little Prell reference for you, my friend, Mr. Quaff Man. I figured you'd dig the shampoo, yeah. Kind of. Never mind.
But this is the same conversation. Like, you could replace everything we're saying with ORM, and we could be having this conversation 5 years ago. Like, organizations will never use InHibernate, or, you know, like, we have to have our stored procedures. It's a security thing. It's a performance thing. So, it's just the same conversation 5 years from now. You know, Microsoft's going to have their own document database, SQL Server, doc, or something like that, and it'll become, people will start using it, and it'll get popular in enterprises, and it'll be out there. And I think, you know, we'll be on to something else, and that's just kind of the role that I think we have to have, is trying the newer things and seeing what works.
You know, that actually, you know, I'm gonna derail this conversation. Sorry.
Nice pun. Didn't they already have that with the SQL XML stuff?
Yeah, SQL CLR objects.
SQL CLR.
Yeah, kind of, but
they have the SQL for XML and all that kind of junk.
Yeah, but it's not the same.
Right.
Well, I mean, so this all is like, this is great from the development side, you know? And I know the response to this, but from the development side, yes, it's very quick to throw data into you know this magic gob and just run and don't think about you know a schema because there you know it doesn't even matter. But as you know your boss or whatever, I would need to weigh okay, so this is cutting down X percent of your development time, but you know then there's maintainability and supportability issues that you know I'm not sure that you've thought through, you know.
But it's actually, I think it's easier to maintain and support. And I think the interesting thing is that it actually makes more sense to business users as well, because it's something they're used to.
Exponentially.
It's like, you know, if you're like, I did a big insurance app and we always had the problem of, you know, well, where's the policy? Well, the policy is spread across 30 tables, right? In a document database, it would be, here's your policy. And it would be this one chunk of data and they could probably read it. Even if it was JSON, a business user could say, this is a policy. I understand that. It's not spread across 1,000 tables and, you know, impossible to decipher and work with. And we have less maintenance costs because if I want to add a field to one policy, let's say they start insuring a new type of insurance. We just add it to the policy and we save it. We don't have to worry about running the migration against a table with 200 gigs of data. I mean, if you ever tried to add a column or remove one with any large table, it's awful. You don't have to worry about that, right? I mean, businesses are flexible that way. They're not business users don't want to be jammed into these relational databases they can't change. To them, it doesn't make sense.
Well, see, and the interesting thing about what you brought up, John, is that's an excellent way to stifle any kind of progress whatsoever.
Aha! You see how I work?
In order to really study the maintainability and portability and whatever of technology X versus technology Y, you have to perform a study. So you have to see, okay, so how much longer does this take to change, to back up, to, you know, whatever, how much space is this going to take, how is our backup
policy?
Enterprise.
All I'm proposing is that we'll form a committee and we'll meet every Wednesday morning for 2 hours.
John's suddenly and the anal exactly retentive of IT
that's
guy.
What we'll get done. And so they'll say, well, before we can really do that, you have to really compare the two.
We don't
have to have the lead architect do it, and it never, ever will happen.
Sure. I so know the world John Galloway is living in right now.
No, I'm just trying to think through, you know, if I'm trying to sell something to my boss, I have to think about what, you know, what's on their mind, you know, and that's always something where it's like, well, okay, so how do we handle...
You just tell Hanselman you want to look at MongoDB and you can stuff it if he doesn't like it.
ASP.NET website's going to run on Mongo. I'm saying it right here, John. You're going to make it happen?
Who knows? Yeah, I'll bang it out tonight. Don't worry about it.
It's my first effort of putting.
If there was ever a Microsoft site crying out for a document database, it would be MSDN.
Nope.
Well, but then they'd have to change the URLs again.
They might actually be closer to that than you think, but
it would have.
Well, John, you know, it's worth pointing out to answer your question really quickly. So a couple things to consider at the point you raised. One, you know, managers' concerns are going to be, can my developers pick this up? There is no picking it up. You save an object. So if you've established any kind of repository or any sort of like wrapper around DB4O or whatever thing you're using, it just is. So there's that. Thing two is, can it scale? And a lot of people ask this. What's the scaling on it? And the largest databases in the world run on object databases. High capacity, gnarly, major petabyte sized databases run on these things. Finally, the fastest database interactions ever recorded were for an object database. They don't have joins. They use pointers. And right there, anybody who does, of course, computing might understand that, you know, joins are expensive running a query, but pointers are just part of the fabric. So right there, a lot of the management concerns are mitigated. I mean, it stares you in the face. It's a better solution. And I'm telling you, system.persistence is a namespace that's going to be in the .NET platform within 10 years.
So you can't use this from Visual Basic.
One thing I want to deal with again. It's
What's Visual Basic? What's that? Oh, that's that WebForms language.
Don't! Did I say WebForms? No!
Now, Rob, you know that WebForms is a lifestyle choice, and people should be accepted and loved for who they are if they choose to.
Don't ask, don't tell, right? Uh-oh.
Exactly.
And I am so in trouble. Okay, WebForms folks, I love you all. I just was joking.
That's not what you were saying earlier, Rob.
I don't love them. They need 21st century.
Wait, okay, so this is a good segue.
Come on, Mr. Lying Plate of Spaghetti. Isn't that what you wrote?
Ooh, me? Did I write that?
Oh, it was beautiful prose. It was.
Are you talking to me? I'm sorry, I didn't pick it up.
Yes, I was talking to you, Rob. It was the prose about. I'll have to look it up now. It was something like a lie on a plate of deceit.
Oh, yes.
Lying yes. gravy and more lying.
Wrapped in another lie with a plate of lie sauce. Yes. Yeah.
With. In a burrito.
That's what I get for trying to be... Okay, so I meant to hijack the post with it, or the post. I meant to hijack the show with this, but I got derailed. Scott Kuhn overrode me. So honestly, seriously, the conversations, because at the time, we're talking about conversations and how we're going to have the same conversations again in another 5 years, and conversations cycle through. And yet again, we find ourselves in the middle of this MVC web forums battle. I know a lot of folks, of course, out there listening aren't privy to some of the mailing lists that we're all on, but there has been some nasty, nasty go-arounds. And not only that, but people are starting to really flame up the blogosphere with this MVC versus web forums thing. And I swear, I make a good-hearted attempt at trying to help out, and I'm not even going to talk about the post I made because I got flamed really hard for that. You know, not only just on my post, but in emails too. What the heck is going on with all this negativity out there, man? Really? I swear, it's a massive schism. I mean, Scott Kuhn, I talked to you about this earlier today, and you were really upset.
Dude, it's such a pile of crap. It's the
Let it out, buddy. We're here for you.
They call the MVC people elitist. They say, you know, I had tons of other problems with said mailing list in terms of the tone and the way that we were being told to kowtow to the marketing line. That was just utter crap. But, you know, so that's another issue. But the whole MVC versus web forms, I mean, people are allowed to have opinions. And if my opinion is that going forward, if I'm ever working on Greenfield development, my first instinct is going to be to start up, you know, a new MVC project versus a new web forms project. You know, given all things being equal, you know, that's okay too. If you want to choose web forms, that's okay if you want to choose it. But, you know, don't tell me that I can't say that I prefer MVC. And it's funny because the argument that comes back is use the right tool for the right job. But as soon as you start to look at, you know, something like Rails, you're supposedly, you know, alt.net is abandoning .net for Rails. No, we're picking the right tool.
When is web forms ever the right tool?
Oh, he said it.
If you're doing .NET new module development,
no. If you have
ladies and gentlemen, the podcast has left the building.
No, so I mean, I'm just being honest because I was actually had to do some web form stuff today for a tech pub screencast. You see another plug? And I honestly couldn't remember how to even
which,
do it.
Which screencast was that? Wait, I'm sorry.
This is the Mastering jQuery screencast with Dave Ward.
I bet you ate lunch with a tech pub screencast today too, didn't you?
I did. We it was Subway. Yeah. They're a lounge spot. No, just so. So no, but seriously, I mean, I tried
Zerk.
I tried to do web forms, and I honestly couldn't remember how to do it because it's really been about 3 years since I've done any web forms. And at the end of it, I thought I can't imagine a scenario where I would choose to use web forms for a new application.
Using web forms is easy, James. You just think spaghetti instead of lasagna.
Oh boy!
But honestly, I mean, people say the right tool for the right job, and I just think, like, I was talking to Rob about this earlier. I think web forms is basically dead. And if you want to do real web development, if you want to do public internet development, if you really want to make a semantic website, you're going to use MVC. And if you want to do a quick internet application, you're going to use Silverlight.
Are you going to make me do the marketing speak here?
No, I'll do it for you because I'm practiced at it. Look, I got 2.5 years under, you know, I could do this. So, really quickly, James, I mean, you know this, but it's worth saying so people don't think that we're just railing here. I mean, the truth of it is that the time that it's the right job is when you have an investment in it. You're in a big company and you have to use it because that's what you use and it's what you know. Yeah.
No, if it's a legacy situation, that's still valid. I mean, there's people out there who still use classic ASP for the last 8 years because they had a huge code base that couldn't be rewritten. There's millions of lines of COBOL. I don't think they should go rewrite it. They have to deal with it. That's where web forms is, though. For not for
no kidding,
like, why would you go start a new project in web forms? I don't understand.
Well, I don't think if you're doing the intranet application, you necessarily jump right into Silverlight. It's a big jump for a lot of people.
It might be. And actually, I don't really care for Silverlight that much. I mean, because I usually do public web stuff. But to me, that's how I look at it from and going forward, that's going to be the big decision. Like where it used to be, people would fight over, should we do web forms or should we do like a Windows client? Because I mean, 8 years ago or 7 years ago, whatever, we were doing Windows clients with remoting for internet stuff. Uh-huh. I think Silverlight's going to take that over as saying, we just need an internet application. So do it in Silverlight or do it with MVC. I mean, I would still do it with MVC even for an internet because I prefer web applications. But I just don't think that web forms is going to get squeezed out.
What's interesting, Kate Scott, I want to ask you a question. You wrote a great blog post on this where you said, they're asking the question about web forms being dead is the wrong question. I'm paraphrasing. I'm sure I'm getting this wrong. But you made a little spectrum on your blog post, and you put MVC on one end, web forms in the middle, and SharePoint on the other. So, what do you think about all this? I have my opinions, but I generally try and keep them to myself. But I know you're going to laugh, but it's funny because even if you say on your blog, even if you title the damn blog, you should learn MVC. People say, oh, you're telling me what to do again. You're being condescending and rude. Like, no, I'm really not. In fact, the odd thing about the last post I read is I never once said that you couldn't do any of those productivity things without, I didn't say that you couldn't do them with web forms. And people are like, you're bashing web forms. Like, I'm actually not. I'm just saying productivity means something different. It doesn't mean dragging and dropping things onto a page and just spitting them back out. It means doing these other things. And if you reevaluate your criteria in light of this, you start to see why people dig MVC. That was my only statement. Man, did I get a bunch of garbage. So anyway, so Kay Scott, back to you. That spectrum, what do you think?
Latest thing.
Well, I think people that are developing public internet websites are going to lean towards MVC all the time. But once you get inside the corporate firewall, I think it's a completely different situation. There, I think you have web developers who are going to ultimately, in a couple of years, either be looking at, well, there's three choices there. They might go with MVC if they're like James. So they're just comfortable web developers and they like all the things that MVC offers. But for a lot of corporate developers, I think it's going to come down to web forms versus SharePoint. And I think SharePoint's going to win a majority of those cases in the coming years because if they've already got a few years of web development, of web forms development underneath their belts, and they're just going to slide into SharePoint and be happy in that environment, be happy where you can just drag and drop stuff and use a big honking framework that already throws up lists and takes care of authentication and personalization and all that stuff for you. It's just all going to be there. So that leaves, there's going to be the hardcore MVC developers that are using it for public websites and occasionally inside the firewall. And then you have everyone else who's just going to look at the difference between web forms and SharePoint and say, oh, but I get all this other stuff in SharePoint already. It's already portalized and componentized and customized. I'm going to use that stuff.
And the same thing.
One more thing is the third choice is Silverlight. So that might come into play in a couple places. But I still think for a lot of developers who have just been doing web stuff for a few years, it's a big leap. I mean, I was just trying to explain, why do you use Capture Mouse to someone the other day who, had never done any sort of desktop development.
See, I see something totally different. All sarcasm and snark aside, traditionally, Microsoft has had one way to do things. You do it, here, you want to do your C++ app, here's Win32. You do, your .NET desktop app, here's Win. They just finally, even when they released XAML and WPF, they said, okay, well, WinForms, it's still supported. We're not really going to do much new stuff on it. And I think the same thing is going to happen with MVC and traditional web forms in that they're going to start borrowing from each other. They're already starting to do it. ASP.NET web forms, has already borrowed things like the routing engine and some other things like that. And and MVC still doesn't have a really good component control story. They've kind of got area in there, but it's not really the same thing. You kind of do it with these expression based HTML helpers, which I hate. I'd much rather do it the jQuery templated plugin kind of route. But I think that we'll start to see them kind of merge, so that we'll have kind of web forms classic which has everything kind of tightly coupled together with the code behind and all that. And you'll be able to run it that way. And I think they're going to find some way to merge it so that you can do kind of front controller web form pages. And you'll be able to use traditional kind of maybe version, let's call them V2 user controls and web controls inside of MVC of view engines.
This is making me think, listening to you, because I read a CodeBetter post today that a guy, Ian Cooper, posted called WitherAlt.net, and maybe some folks out there have read it. And it's basically saying, hey, what happened to alt.net? You know? And one of the comments that came in on that post down below is like, well, all the alt.net, big guys went to Rails. And it made me laugh because I know a lot of them actually have started dabbling in Rails. And this is the interesting thing, and I'm going to bring it back to what you were saying, is that Microsoft has to straddle two audiences now. It has to deal with two developer audiences, which now are sort of squabbling, right? And so it's got to make MVC appealing to its massive web forms base, and it's also got to make MVC appealing to folks who are kind of looking out the door at Rails and other frameworks, right? So what you're going to end up with is this kind of amalgamation. This is all me just sort of pontificating. I have no idea what's going on. The point being is, you get something. The power of Rails is because it's an opinionated thing. It's like, this is the way you do it, and Ruby's an awesome language. And so people find freedom there. They can just address the business concern, and off they go. But with MVC, it still leaves a lot of doors open. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? People get lost. They don't know where their server controls are. They don't know what's going on. And so you kind of sit there and you think, whoa, you know what? This is a weird play. This is a weird time. There's a lot of disruption happening. So I want to throw that out there. I mean, John Galloway, you got to have an answer for us. I'm just kidding.
Well, no. I've been trying to, I've been typing my little things in the chat window. Ready to talk now. Hey, me, please.
And I'm sorry.
Stomped on, jerks.
Wait, pin the tail on John Galloway. Here we go.
Well, okay. So as we're talking about this, I mean, MVC and Rails are generally code-focused development, right? I mean, and so people that... probably all of us are more comfortable, we think in code when we approach a problem. However, there are a lot of concepts you have to talk through when you're, talk about teaching your kid how to write a web page. And you're like, okay, well, there's this route and there's this controller and see, well, which one puts the content on the screen? Well, wait, we're not done yet. Then there's this view, but nobody just uses that. Now we need like a view model. And then there's these service classes and, here's how we hook all this together. And, whereas there is definitely like an immediacy to putting a text box and a button, and you can't tell me there's similarities in learning curve. Now, obviously, that's not all there is to it. There's quite a bit to the software
page life cycle.
Sure.
Sorry, John. You can edit that out.
That was the sound of the page life cycle crashing down on you. Create child controls. Child controls created? Yes, child controls. Uncreate, create child control.
John has the ability to send use cases your way.
Add an element to WebForms page.
Seriously, there is like a 20-page PDF out there with the ASP.NET for a page lifecycle.
See, that's always been my contention. People say they're not smart enough to figure out MVC, but if you can learn the page cycle, you can learn anything.
it's true. I actually, I was helping someone with their presentation talking about WebForms. And they said, I'm going to show the new stack with this new lifecycle on it. And I was like, if you do that, man, because, the MVC presentation is coming next and you show that lifecycle, I don't know if that's going to go over so good.
But, the lifecycle is not really a problem that you hit for a long time. And often when you really hit that wall, you're doing something wrong. So, it is true that it is there. And that's something where you pay the piper later. Like, sure, you can drag and drop some stuff on. And then all of a sudden you're like, well, wait, I need access to this thing after this is clicked, but before this is processed, but I need my view state. But, so yes, you can back yourself into a corner, but it's not for a while.
I totally disagree that it takes a while to hit that corner.
Yeah, me too. I tend to hit it pretty fast.
As soon as you add anything dynamically to the page, like if you say, okay, so there are five of these things in the database, so I need to add these five controls these five user controls, which I'm using to correctly abstract away, you know, and reuse code.
See, you're getting fancy there, Scott. We don't know what you're talking about. Just draggity droppity, man. Just drag five controls on. If there's more in the database, you just drag some more on.
There'll never be more than 10, so we'll just drag 10 on.
Put 10 on and hide them if it's not the database. You're done. You're overthinking it, man.
Did you guys hear all those clicks? I think that was everybody, you know, web forms developers out there listening, turning off their iPods.
Man, they don't have iPods. They have Zooms, man. They have Zooms.
I'm just saying that they
got a Zoom in their left pocket and a Windows mobile phone in their right pocket.
James, we have successfully destroyed this episode.
Should I just wind it up here? Oh, I'm not the
MC. One thing. So one thing that Kay Scott said that I think was totally right is that I think what Microsoft is doing is moving to more platform development like SharePoint. And the other one they're really pushing is CRM. And so I think that's going to be more and more their answer instead of like, oh, build your own app in web forms or Silverlight, like I was saying. And it's going to be just build on top of SharePoint, whatever it is, build on top of SharePoint or build on top of CRM instead of trying to build your own app.
Yep.
Well, one other thing to go back to earlier is there, like someone was saying that the differences are definitely bleeding over into each other. So like in ASP4, like a lot of the things that people hated or disliked, especially in the web friendliness world of web forms, is going away. You know, like the client ID annoyance is finally getting fixed, so you can actually write jQuery and you can not have CTL00 underscore blah 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 all over your page. You know. So there are a lot of things where
actually I think what you said was shorter.
Blah, blah, blah. I can just repeat that blah, blah, blah for a while.
Yeah, man, you got to get into the nested, you know, second nested table.
But I mean, really, it does come down to there's this common thing that everything's running on, right? There's this, both of them share all the goo as far as get a request, send a response, and then it's the development style on top of it.
I did have one last question before we go. I'm trying to figure out, I wrote it down, I'm trying to find it. Oh, yeah.
I had something that was more on track, but it goes back at the beginning of the show when we were talking about normal things.
I thought we jumped over the whole Wither alt.net thing.
Well, so it had to go back to
this has left me so confused, this podcast.
It had to do with what James was saying about how when you started getting into these nested object graphs and relational databases. And I don't know how MongoDB or Couch or whatever the Amazon thing is called, how that really
Dynamo?
Helped. Dynamo, that's what it was. I don't know how that solves those problems of having nested related entities within a database.
You just have a document. So you have instead of having a so basically like
you in just an have a doc, you have a person document that owns a policy document.
Right. Well, you still have some connections like that. Like you may have things actually in an insurance case, a policy would probably own the person. The person would probably be a sub part of the policy. So you would actually have, so instead of having a policy object, which is actually 37 tables, and you have to worry about pulling all that together and saving it all, you just have one, you have a document, it's called policy, and you save it into your database.
Yeah, but so I delete that person. That person leaves.
So what you wouldn't delete, why would you wouldn't delete a person. You would delete a policy, and that might delete the person record inside the policy.
But I need to keep that policy around because, you know, I need to know that they had this policy when it expired.
Right, so you just mark it as expired. I mean, you don't need it because we have this like fetish with like making everything normalized, or it's like, you know, oh, we have to have the address has, you know, a person can have multiple addresses, so we have to have an address table, and then if we change the address, it'll change it on all their things. But that usually creates more bugs than it helps. And it you know, chances are you're better off just duplicating the address. And if you need to go update it in multiple places, do that. It's not that big a deal.
Well, that was because hard disks weren't cheap and they weren't big.
Right. Originally. No, I was going to say, it was totally a hard drive driven choice. Is that you said, okay, you know, it makes a lot of sense to, you know, to do that, to optimize it for hard drive space, but it really doesn't matter anymore. I mean, hard drive space now is 10 times cheaper than almost any other resource.
You know, every time someone tells me that normalized databases are good, I think back to the time when I moved out from my parents' house and I changed my address, and all of a sudden, all of my parents' bank statements started coming to my house.
Tell me about it. We stayed with my parents for 3 months, and when we moved, they're getting our mail, we're getting theirs, and there is no fixing it.
Well, and then you even end up denormalizing it when you, like, you have an order, and you're like, oh, well, this address has to stay with the order. So you have your address table, and you have your order address table, and you have to copy it over there and make sure it's separate, and it's like, it just makes more sense if you deal with objects or documents.
Yeah, I was gonna respond to you on that one, Scott, that this is one of those things where you kind of put a line in your application and you say, you know, what's current and then what's legacy? Information, not, you know, of course, code. So in the example that you brought up, you know, I have this policy, but I removed the person from the policy, blah, blah, blah. All that information should be in some sort of audit table somewhere where the person's record is flattened out, normalized, and or denormalized, whatever. And you have that as a matter of record. You shouldn't need to use your current application to go get that information. So that's thing one. Thing two is that if you work with an object-oriented database like Matisse or I think Pearst is one, and then DB4O is another one, a lot of these things comply with ACID sort of database relational rules. Where, meaning, like, if you have if you have embedded objects like a person and a policy, the system will actually split them apart and we'll conjoin them based on pointers. So you could query freely for a person, and it would come up as, you know, a person. And then you could also query for your policy, and the person would be embedded in that policy. So I just wanted to add that.
Okay, so I have two follow-up questions to that.
Oh, God, Kevin's talking.
I'm talking. Finally getting my word
in
here.
Dude, what happened there? I was like, who's this guy? Somebody jumped in our
Skype Don't worry,
chat.
Guys. I'll cut it out after when we...
thanks.
So with document-oriented databases, I mean, you're storing this sort of JSON-style representation of your objects. But at some point, it seems like there's still a mapping between this JSON structure and your object model. And so it seems like you would end up with an object database mapper instead of an object relational mapper.
That's
the genius of JSON. You just deserialize it to an object, and boom, there it is.
Yep. Yeah, it's the equivalent of saying you would need a mapper for pulling something out of session. Well, it's still serialized in session, but it's your object. It just comes back. There's not a mapping there, so that's why you don't have to worry about that.
But at least in strongly typed languages, your object may change. Your persistent form is whatever it was, whatever the structure was when it was persisted. Mm-hmm. So how do you bring those two together as you evolve your object model?
How do you version these documents going forward? So if it changed so the policy now has, you know, writers attached to it, what happens to the old policy? Do they just end up with empty writers?
Right. They would just end up with empty writers, basically.
So you basically do a big update that goes through and updates every document in the table or in the
No, you don't have to. It just wouldn't be there. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of JSON or even, dare I say, XML. You know, that's why we like to go into web services, because if the writer's collection wasn't there in the JSON object, then when you go to pull it out, you just have an empty collection or a null collection on your C# object.
So you end up having to write in lots of null guard in your
It
right?
seems like not just null guards, but also type checking and all that kind of stuff too, right? I mean, because it's just a property bag, you can throw whatever you want in. That's great, but now your code has to compensate.
Right. So you started off, your SKUs were all numbered, and then somebody started putting.
That's not the way it works.
That's the way it works.
The static language is definitely not as good a fit as dynamic language.
Right. Right. And in some sense, I think it goes back to the robustness principle, which has made the web work so well for so long, which is just be generally liberal in what you accept.
Yeah. I mean, if you go and you have, like, you know, we talked about SKUs on a product before. If you have, let's say our SKU was all number based and it's integer, and we said, oh, okay, this is what we're going to do. And then someone says later on, no, they need to be strings because we're going to throw X's in there now. And then you go and you change your typing. The database will actually try and facilitate that. It'll do its best to coerce the value that's in the system into your new type. But if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I mean, and the only thing you can really do at that point is say, well, of course it's not going to work. You know what I mean?
Is that the of course it's not going to work exception that you throw?
Yeah, actually, it's a are you an idiot exception. No, of course not. I want to keep hearing from Kevin. Where'd he go?
Sorry, I was muted. this goes back to some of the discussion we were having on Twitter about this, which is, especially with object databases, I mean, I think document databases, there's some, you're sort of divorced from your object model and your persistence model. But with object databases, it seems like if you're you're storing C-sharp objects in your object database, what happens 10 years from now when you're not using C-sharp objects anymore? Or what happens as you, again, the versioning question, how do you evolve your object model without...
Right. I'm actually, I don't, I think the doc, that's why document database, that's why object databases didn't take off as much as they could have. And that's why document databases will, because it's slightly more open, right? It's like JSON, or in Mongo's case, it's BSON. It's like binary JSON that anything, it could convert into anything. So I think that's why you'll see document databases get much more popular than object databases.
I agree.
All right. No comment. Yes, I am going to live my whole life in fear. Damn it. No, I mean, I say that because I work on a very long-lived product that has been around for like 20 years.
Yeah.
And has evolved from, you know, Lisp to VB to .NET.
Web forums, and now it's in SharePoint.
Web forums, okay, absolutely. All of the above.
In case Scott knows the pain of medical data. Is that from a bit to a yes, no, to a LH for low and high, just over the course of 8 years.
I've been in hospitals that are still using MUMPS databases, which was developed in, I don't know, the 1500s or something like that. It was about the time of the Crusades, I think.
Is this where we get to launch into a Civil War story? Because that was one of the best podcasts I've ever heard. I liked your Civil War story, but how I forgot what it was about. But I really liked it.
Yeah, they won't let me do it anymore.
Oh, see, that was like K. Scott's fireside story time.
It was about General Washington crossing the Mississippi or something.
Yes,
it was inspiring. Declaring,
it was what does victory mean or something like that. I actually thought it was really, really good. In all seriousness,
he's only allowed to tell.
So you know what? I really, before we go, I kind of want to. I'm sitting here. I'm sort of feeling a little sheepish and almost a little bit scared. And I think it's because I have faced the wrath of Twitter audience, blog audience, general web.net ASP audience for jumping my case for ripping on web forms. They feel like I'm being condescending and rude, you know. And I think with all the laughter that we've been having, I think it's just kind of funny because, I mean, we're letting off steam, right? So this is the truth of it all. We're kind of letting off a little steam. We're having a little fun. It's funny to say things that are, you know, sort of in your face and whatever. But, you know, the truth of it is this is kind of the way people react to really difficult situations. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out because I really don't want people to be offended by the discussion we're having. I think we've been down those roads so many different ways, and we've had issues that we've faced. And I think for us to see the frustration and anger that gets thrown back at us when people try and share their points of view and offer different ideas, I kind of just want to throw it out there because I don't really want people to think we're being, I don't know, dickheads, I guess is the best way to put it. Or are you guys okay with that?
I'd like to have a group hug now, if it's okay.
You can hug me anytime. Just got to put that hair in a ponytail. It's the only thing I ask.
See, I don't see why. I'm with actually with Scott Kuhn on this, so maybe that makes me a dickhead too. But it's like why should it ever be perceived as being a dick when you're just stating your opinion? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just my opinion that MVC is the way to go and that I would never use web forms. If you want to use it, that's fine. I don't care. But I don't see why that should be, you know, a big deal.
Sure. I absolutely agree. I totally agree with you. You know, I think for me, it's, you know, people are so quick to see anything you say and parse it into some, oh, he's bashing, you know. And I think it's easy for folks to be sitting here listening to us tonight and thinking, oh, these guys are being jerks, you know. And I think for me, you know, I said before we came on here, I sent everybody a bunch of emails. I'm like, I really want to face this tonight, you know, because I think there's a massive schism in the developer audience. Where on one hand, you know, the web forums guys are looking over the fence, you know, it's like the Jets and the Sharks, right? You know, looking over the fence, like those guys are saying, you know, talking trash, right? And, you know, we're over here like, it's cool to be a Shark. It's cool to be a Jet. I don't know, pick your dang side. You know what I'm saying? It's like, we don't think we're cooler than anybody. It's just, it's kind of humorous to see the amount of invective that's just thrown into this discussion. And we haven't even discussed VB yet.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's the same conversation as VB.NET and C-sharp and stored procedures versus ORMs, and it's just the same conversation over and over and over again that people get offended about and then eventually go one way or the other, or don't. I was at CodeStock and there was an open space on like why store procedures, like why you shouldn't use store procedures. And I was like, we're still having this conversation. Like this was 8 years ago. There's still people out there who say we should use store procedures for everything. And there are. And if they want to go do that, that's, you know, okay. It doesn't hurt me. If somebody wants to write code in whatever language they want, you know, why, I don't know why people take such offense to people just stating an opinion of what they like to use. To me, well, it's about what you do with it. You know, if you want to go use Lisp and write a kick-ass website with Lisp, then awesome, do it. If you want to use web forms, if you want to use Access, I don't care. Build something meaningful and focus on the actual value that we get from it. We're, you know, we just like being geeks and we like focusing on the tool we use instead of what you actually do with it.
Well, I think this actually does circle back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier with the whole alt.net and what's in a name and blah, blah, blah. But I think a lot of the discussion with why, you know, what people like about MVC always circles back to a comparison of what they don't like about web forms. And I mean, that definitely is, you know, that's been part of what people are talking about tonight. And I mean, it's, you know, I mean, you have to have make comparisons and all that, but I do see that, like, and with the whole, you know, alt.net thing, it's people were saying, well, what if it was just called, you know, open.net or whatever. And I do think that there are some things about a name where you're kind of putting it in opposition to something that it does define the conversation a little bit.
Right. It's easiest to define something by saying what it's not.
Right. Yes. I mean, I don't. Wait, did you trick me? I don't know. I'm the advice council. I refuse to answer.
This is the part where I say that my little, you know, group hug ramble was, you know, I wasn't really serious. I was just saying that so John wouldn't be mad at me, and I was trying to draw him back into the conversation, and I think it worked.
Well, so Jedi, these are Jedi mind tricks now, is that what you're saying?
Totally.
You have to consider that a lot of times that these people have invested years and years and years in building their business based upon their expertise. And this goes for any technology. And that's why people tend to take their technology choice so personally, and it becomes a part of them. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these people make their living speaking as a web forms expert. So, and it's one of the reasons that I haven't jumped over to Rails or Django development. So right now I'm, you know, I guess I'm senior. I guess if 5 years of experience can be considered senior, I guess 15 is senior. I don't know what's more senior than senior. My grandpa developer, I don't know. So right now I'm senior when
manager.
I'm .NET. Oh, God. But if I jump to Rails, then suddenly I'm like junior. So I have to take a pay cut to go do something that I'd like, which, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow.
I think so.
Hey, I'm going to take this job that pays $40,000 a year less because it's something I love doing. and you see where you're sleeping that night.
This sounds like the Mike Gundelroy Fresh Cup scenario.
Wait, didn't Rob do that? No.
I did. I did. I left a good job, but it wasn't for anything negative. I mean, it's what I wanted to do. But yeah, basically, I'm not kidding. I'm eating ramen. Well, James can tell you. I call him all, dude, where's the money, man?
Is that a good segue to talk about what you guys are doing?
Sure.
Or not. Wait, Kevin's in charge. I'll let him make that
something
decision.
To do with Drek Jub. It's the tech grub.
Kevin, take control of this thing.
You guys have a food site? Is that what it is?
So, is there anything that you guys would be interested in pimping again on the podcast?
Oh, boy.
No, let's tell us about TechBub, because we haven't actually talked about it on the show, and I actually think it's a fantastic site. So,
James, you go.
Me go. You have to go, Rob. I think you have to give the intro to it.
Okay. Well, you know, so I'm going to actually tie up our previous points and segue into our new points. I actually, you know, it's funny. Before I came on the show tonight, I wrote a post that I called Asking the Mountain to Come to You. And it was a response, not a really response. It was just sort of holding up a mirror to Ian Cooper's post about, you know, that I started talking about before, about, you know, what's happening with alt.net. And it basically said, you know, really, you've kind of framed this as a war. You know, you framed this as the cause, the great movement, right? And if you're serious about that, let's just crack open The Art of War by Sun Tzu and see what he's got to say. And if you reason through a lot of those tenets of The Art of War, basically it always comes back to you and the choices that you make, right? So if you really want to affect change, you can only do what you can do. But sometimes if you hit the right spot at the right time, that's an awful lot. And so for me, you know, I saw a lot of things going on, and I still do, right, in every developer arena. And I thought, you know, the one thing that is happening here is dogma. So much dogma and crazy opinion coming from everywhere. And I thought, you know, the one thing that you can do is shine a light on all of this hyperbole and all of this rambling that people are doing in these blog posts and this gnarly negativity. Shine a light on it and show what it means and let people make up their own damn mind. And so that's where I started the storefront stuff, and it kind of people reacted very good to that. And I thought, gosh, you know, if I could do this full time, if I could devote my career to just educating people and take a step back necessarily from standing on a soapbox and, you know, saying you need to do X, Y, Z and just say, here it is. That to me would be great. And so anyway, tying those two things together, my whole thing about asking the mountain to come to you is, you know, really you can only do so much, right? If you sit there and write these posts and rant at the gates of the Colossus, you know, what's going to happen? But if you turn your back the other direction to the crowd that's behind you, and you just start speaking about, you know, the points that are being made, the technology ideas that are out there, not just within the realms of what you're comfortable with, but within everything, right? So, like, I just pushed a whole series on Rails. And, you know, I also pushed a series about how to build an application on my blog using ASP.NET MVC. I'm leaving it up to people to contrast the two. I try not to do that in both series. I don't want to say Rails is better at something and MVC is better at something. I'll let people make up their own minds. So to me, that's what TechPub's about. You know, just here, educate yourself. You make up your own mind and let's stop fighting.
Can't we all just get along? So when you guys started TechPub, it was mostly Microsoft.NET kind of focused stuff. And recently that's been changing.
Well, it's funny. The first screencast that Rob did was actually Git. So Git was done before anything else, and before we even did, like the blog, or Rob did the blog one, and before Hibernate was even started. So really, we started out with Git because we thought, you know, one, Rob was really digging it at the time and still digging it. But it's, you know, it's a technology that everyone should be using, but is definitely not a mainstream kind of .NET technology at all.
Okay, fair enough. Although in the open source world, it's kind of taken that whole world by storm, including the .NET open source world. So,
except for Jeff Atwood, he seems to have a problem with it. Yeah.
Yes, he does.
It's just GitHub. He can't
too use many
GitHub.
Support emails.
Right?
Yeah. Darn those users.
It does seem to be something that's crossing the platform boundaries, though, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. But anyway, now I'm seeing more stuff coming out of you guys about Rails and Linux and. Are you guys aiming to be totally platform agnostic at this point and just cover whatever's interesting or what's your goal?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we basically want to just show, we want to be about programming, but not tied to a platform, because more and more, this is kind of a totally different argument. But one of the things I've realized in the last couple of years is that I don't care what platform somebody knows as much as I care what kind of programmer they are. Like I would take somebody who I think is really good. Like, so I'd take K Scott to on a Rails app before I would take some guy who happens to know Rails that isn't as smart as K Scott, because I know that like K Scott could freaking learn Rails no problem and get, you know, use it. I mean, technologies aren't that hard to learn. The hard part is becoming a really good developer. And so like, yeah, I mean, that's totally our goal, is to focus, have stuff on Rails, have stuff on .NET. You know, we're talking about doing Django stuff, Mongo stuff, CouchDB stuff. I mean, really anything that a programmer would be interested in, we want to cover.
Yeah, there's lots of education there. I mean, if you talk about, you know, I've received so many emails from people who have read or watched the Rails thing. And, you know, a lot of them are like, oh my God, I can't wait to try this. And I swear to God, that is just fires me up. Because if someone was to try Rails and see a different way of doing something, I mean, chances are they're not going to leave their platform. They're just going to rethink the way they're approaching it. And maybe they're going to adopt some different ways of doing it. So for instance, Cucumber is a BDD testing tool, right? That is so freaking easy to use when you're building out a Rails site that it makes you want to do, you know, TDD and, well, you know, BDD, right? You get into it and you all of a sudden realize the value of doing it. And then, okay, so maybe my next project's not going to be Rails, it'll be MVC, but darn it, I had so much fun doing BDD. Well, I'm going to make it work for me with MVC. And then, you know what? For me, a mission accomplished.
We didn't even have a lightning round.
Oh, yeah. Do you have items?
I just had one. Just one simple one.
Okay.
Well, go for it.
All right. I wanted to know, out of this group, who was the person that most recently opened the Visual Basic 6 IDE?
It's been at least 8 years.
Yeah, me too. What about John?
You know, I actually did in the past year. I wrote this Okay. I wrote a drum machine with DirectX and all this stuff, and it was in Windows 98, VB6 and stuff. Lately, I was like, I want to check that out because it was actually kind of cool, and just could not seem to get it to work. So.
Huh.
Yeah.
Rob, you ever opened Visual Basic 6? You ever used it?
Oh yeah, yeah. I actually wrote a pretty intense application with it way back in the day. I wrote a simulator for a call center. It was actually for what's now AT&T, but it was Ameritech back then. It was a baby Bell, and we had to build a call center simulator. And this thing would actually play recorded calls, and it would simulate a telephone. So we skinned it, believe it or not, to actually look like a phone. And the rep would come and sit down, and they'd talk to it, and we had voice recognition software going on, and we parse the words, match it to some criteria, and actually gave them a score at the very end. And we could give them prompts. It was actually really intense, but yeah, it was pretty cool watching the code that I got to write. But you know, I will say this. It was a testament to what you could do with VB. I mean, it would have taken us three times as long to do anything like that in C. But that was what, 9 years ago, and no, I haven't opened it up since then.
Huh. That's pretty cool. Scott Kuhn, have you opened it?
He's just closing it down now, I think.
His computer's hung.
See, I wanted to ask Kevin. Kevin, when's the last time you opened VB6?
Oh, you had to go there, didn't you?
It sounds like a setup.
This is a total setup. I tweeted that I had just had to a couple days ago. Yes. It's still out there, and it's still running big company stuff.
Did you have to like pull it down off MSDN subscriptions, or do you have it installed like the first thing when you build a computer?
No, I didn't even install Visual Studio 2005 this time.
Stop, Kevin.
My VB6.
What are you doing, Kevin? Stop, Kevin. Do you want me to sing you a song? Okay, come on. Someone's got to know what that's from. No one gets the 2001 reference?
Yeah, 2001.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I mean, you had the voice down, actually. It was pretty good.
I have a cold, so doing my best. Well, I got some questions on Twitter. Just some basic ones. I mean, do you guys mind if I...
Are they abusive questions, Rob?
Well, actually, there was one that I wanted to answer. Someone asks, Elijah Manners asks, what setup do we use for TechPub hardware, operating system software, and so on? And I just wanted to throw that out. We use your standard... We were nicely donated a server from Maximum ASP in return for, you know, prominence on our site. So in case you're going there and you wonder why we have that there, it's because they're giving us server space, which is great. And, it's Windows 2008, R2, SQL Server 2008, MVC, right now version 1, and no tweaks, honestly. And it runs in subsonic, and yeah. Everything's been going pretty good, except for when I push wrongly encoded code pages and we have little Eiffel Towers all over the thing, but that's about it.
So you guys originally, when the site first launched, were doing Silverlight video and have mm-hmm. since switched, right, to Flash?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes.
What was the reasoning behind the switch?
Market forces. You know, and it's one of those things that it's kind of interesting where you cross the line between being a business person, or excuse me, being a geek, versus a business person. I mean, Silverlight's insanely easy just to serve up WMV files, right? But people were going away, and we were losing people because they didn't want to install Silverlight. And you know, James and I talked about it one day, and I said, you know, how many people lose users because of, you know, they don't want to use Flash versus how many people, you know, have told us they hate Silverlight? So it was actually an easy decision. We just flipped out the player. It's not a big deal. And really, that's what it comes down to. We're losing people.
Do you do a lot of other formats? I mean, do you have downloadable? How'd you kind of decide as far as what downloadable formats you have?
Well, Windows Media encodes nice and small. And so we went with that as a download. So you contrast the same encoding settings between Windows Media versus, say, a very popular format like MP4. And the MP4 file is about 30 to 40% bigger. Now, I know there's probably some algorithms I'm not catching, but Windows Media crumples down real small, and it's very responsive, and geez, it looks great, sounds great. So that was a slam dunk. That was easy. The other one, of course, was iPhone. And so, you know, that's pretty simple. But I think it's just an MP4 file. So if you don't have an iPhone, you can use whatever gadget device will handle that resolution, which is 480 by 320, I believe. And then the last one is, let's see, WVU. And the last one we went with was Flash Video, which of course is what we're playing or we're handing down to the video player. And that was the other reason that kind of pushed us to use the Flow Player, is that the Flow Player is our Flash Player. The combination of that and the FLV, Flash Video format, there's a burst that happens. And so we don't have the lag that we used to. And for some reason, the resolution that gets pulled down is about 5 to 10 times crisper than we were getting out of Silverlight. And I don't know why that is. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, like, you know, you want to be a good buddy and support your friends, you know, but at the same time, it's like, man, I got to make a living here and I got to do the best possible thing I can for my users, and kind of had to go with that. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but why do you hate smooth streaming?
Yeah, why do I hate Silverlight too?
We tried to set up smooth. We couldn't get smooth streaming set up right, wasn't it?
Yeah, I tried. I asked Tim Heuer for help, and he, you know, he jumped in, pointed me to some great resources, and I started down that path. And what it came down to was I had to download Encoder, and I'm sure I did it wrong, right? But, you know, I'm happy to kick up smooth streaming as an alternative. You know, it's easy to kick out the player and come up with something different. But it looked like to me what it did was it chunked out a single MP4 file into 4 or 5 files that could be burst at any moment, right? At certain points along the stream. Mm-hmm. But it amounted to about 5 times the size. So, you know, original file at like 200 gigs, or excuse me, yeah, was it
200 megs?
Thank you. Ended up being about, you know, 1.3 gigs when you put it all together.
Yeah.
And so, not a big deal, but when you're paying for your bandwidth, if you hit the limit, that is a big deal, you know? And
yeah.
So that's came down to that.
Yeah, it definitely. And also, I think it can cause more streamed bandwidth too, because you're constantly sending things to your users so that they can jump between the different bit rates and all that.
Right. Because, well, we actually had that problem with the other Silverlight problem, if I remember, was around how many times Silverlight would hit the file. So it would actually make the requests like over and over and over and over and over again. And because we're dealing with authenticated videos, if stuff started to time out, or if like if your session expired, it was still trying to hit all these different little times, you get these weird errors. Whereas with Flash, it's more of a, you know, we're going to go pull this whole video down and play it.
Yeah, the player just seems to wait, where Silverlight seemed to get sort of jumpy and impatient and say, give me the video, give me the video, give me the video, give me the video. And we would track, you know, it's interesting because we track every time someone requests a stream, just because we want to know what's going on. And a couple times, like I saw this one guy, it looked in our logs like he was trying to download the thing 200 times. And I thought, oh man, you know, I hope he's not sharing the address and all this other stuff. But no, it's just his player and he had a bad connection. And, you know, so just to be perfectly clear here, I'm not trying to trash Silverlight. I'm coming straight out saying I'm sure I was doing it wrong, and I asked for help. And I'm, you know, I'll say it again. Shoot, you know, if there's anybody inside the gates there at Microsoft that wants to help and set up smooth streaming, show me the right way to do it, I'm all about it. You know, I certainly don't want to come off saying everything sucks. You know, John.
Right.
I'm trying to make John's job easier here.
Okay. We'll always have Flash though, just because we did find that when, especially talking to other audiences, like when we market Git to other people that, you know, other areas, that they were totally resistant to installing Silverlight.
Oh,
and that's not a consumer problem. That's because we're dealing with programmers and geeks who know what it is, right?
Right.
And that's our audience, unfortunately. Yep. And we got a flood of traffic.
They like hash codes.
We got a flood of traffic from Reddit. You know, we got a Reddit link for some reason. And that's what really tipped it for me, is seeing traffic come in from an alternative, you know, exterior Microsoft source. And you realize how many people you're losing. You're like, oh God, just because of the choice of player? Really? And I remember one day I'm like, well, you know, that's too bad for you. And I thought, what am I saying? You know, no way. And I think James is the one who slapped me upside the head.
Well, did you get... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead, John.
I was going to ask if you got huge waves of traffic coming from the new .NET Kick site.
Oh, nice one.
Nice segue. I like it. Do I get to pimp some more stuff? Nice.
You're like Mr. Pimp right tonight. God, this is good.
That's all I do. That's the only reason I stayed up until 1 o'clock in the morning, is so I could pimp all this stuff.
And James, how many companies do you run exactly?
So not running anymore. So basically, yeah, we have TechPub, and I help launch the new .NET Kicks. And then of course I have the Lounge and like 2 other companies, but
you are a machine.
It's
man.
No more. No more. It's the goal is no new companies in 2010.
See, you guys can't see it, but on video, James and I have video chat going on. He's got the pink feather boa, the bling all over. He's got the gold teeth and the big old feather coat.
I'm just really pimping Rob out. I don't really do anything. I just put him to work and take a piece.
I know. I called him up like, I'll give you some work, man. He's like, I'm going to take a cut. And I'm like, you got it. You don't pay up. I'm coming to thump you. All right.
So what was involved in relaunching .NET Kix?
Okay. Yeah. So basically with .NET Kix, the site has been around forever, but it kind of languished for a long time. So the first step was we had to fix some glaring performance issues. Like it was actually crashing IIS like 3 times a day. So that was the first thing we did. And it was actually Subsonic that was causing the problem.
Wasn't your password set to happiness?
No, it was the problem was Subsonic. It wasn't Subsonic's fault. It was,
listen to you.
It was, they were loading readers without closing them. Like, you know, you have in Subsonic, you can say load from reader, or you can say load and close reader. Like they just loaded reader. So that it would crash because it would run out of connections. So it wasn't really a Subsonic problem. I just wanted to say
right.
That.
Thanks, James.
But no, so then so the next thing was we got it redesigned, got a new design, and we added reputation and added the ability to down kick stuff, basically drop kick stuff to try to keep the quality a little bit higher. But yeah, that was about it really. We've got more changes coming, but I kind of, you know, I think it's high time we had a better open place for .NET topics like that. So, you know, it's not just what's on the big blogs and not just, you know, certain communities, but it's kind of just a good central community for people to go to and, you know, promote what they like and what they're into. And, you know, I think it should be interesting. I guess that's about it.
All right. Is this the time to wrap? Anything else? Going once?
You know what? I've been wanting to give away. You know what? I was sitting there today because I launched another episode in the whole MVC thing, and I got another one on the way tomorrow. And I was sitting there thinking, I'm going to give away an MVC series, you know, because it's fun. You go on Twitter, you do like little DJ giveaways, whatever. So I was sitting there thinking, like, I want to give it to someone, you know, put money where my mouth is, you know, with the whole web forms thing. I give it to someone who's like really into web forms and thinks that MVC sucks. Someone like Joe Brinkman, you know. And I thought, how could I actually form that question without people yelling at me? And I shied away from. So I didn't even try. I felt like saying, tell me MVC sucks.
Just say, have you accepted MVC into your heart?
Well, so are you giving away free crap or not?
Sure, but we're not live on the air, so I can't say next 5 callers. I mean, what are we going to do?
Well, in the few times we've done this, we'll say the first three comments or whatever on the... On
sure.
All right. Yeah, I'll do it. How about this?
And if Joe's listening, he gets one too.
Yeah. Joe. Oh, yeah. So that's right. So if Joe Brinkman... If you're out there, I'm coming for you, man. No, sure, let's do it. Let's say we give away first three, gets an MVC series, and then, I don't know, anything else you want to throw in there, James?
We could give them 30-day access. So they get access to everything.
Oh, all right. Sounds good to me.
Let's do that.
First three what?
First three people to say MVC sucks. How's that?
Okay.
Can have MVC have our tech pub license for 30 days.
Okay.
Not Rob sucks.
That's acceptable too.
That's true. MVC or Rob sucks. That sounds good. Wow. Is there a ghost in your house, Scott? I hear chains rattling in the background. Oh, that's Kevin's house.
Is that me? That's my wife.
Good Lord.
The ghost of Christmas past. Kevin!
I wear the chains I forged in life.
VB6 module is overloading. Set option explicit to true. Oh, I can't believe you got me going there. Oh, God.
Do I just have to hang up? How do we end this?
All right. I'm ending it now.
Kevin has to officially end it.
It is not over until I say it's over. All right. This has been another interminable episode of Herding Code. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
This is K. Scott Allen from odecode.com.
Just wait till you're back in the mainland.
Yes.